Ray.
Hello, David. How are you doing, man?
Doing great. In episode 73.
73? Oh, my God. Yeah.
It's almost as old as you are.
It's older than me, actually, Dave. But thank you for your respect, sir.
So how you doing?
Doing good. I'm sitting here in Kansas, of all places. Yeah. You know, we've been doing all the shows from Alaska, and I'm going to be back in Alaska. I have not moved from Alaska, but I'm in our other place.
Right. So this is California and Kansas connection. We're almost at the same latitude, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Latitudes and attitudes.
Do you know what your latitude is?
I do not. I'm going to have to look that up, man.
Okay. But yeah. I'm at 34, but that's okay. Degrees. Yeah,
we're at an old old building here on Main Street in Lindsborg, Kansas. So you might hear a truck go by or their neighbor stomping around. It's kind of an
urban
scene. Guess
what? I edit these podcasts, so I'll make sure that truck vanishes from our audio landscape.
There goes one right now.
I can't hear it. Hey, so any paleo news today on this beautiful spring day of the time of the year? I won't say what year it is because who knows when you're listening to this podcast. We just had the spring equinox.
The show is timeless, Dave. Timeless.
It's
all about deep time.
So paleo is timeless.
Paleo is timeless. But hey, yeah, I was just moments ago, I was reading in my little news feed, my little science news feed about Kermit Tops. Do you know about Kermit Tops?
The color green.
But anyways, it was sitting on the shelf in the Smithsonian for like 40 years. It was dug up in Texas in the Permian stuff from down there.
Wow.
And it's this cool little skull that looked just like Kermit the Frog. It turns out it is kind of a proto-amphibian because frogs had not quite evolved, but they named it in honor of Kermit the Frog,
sure,
which I think is really cool.
It is cool, but I saw the picture of this nodule. It looks nothing like Kermit the Frog. So am I missing something here? Looks like a piece of coprolite is what it looks
like. Well, maybe in the CT scan they saw it, you know, because they use the CT scans and, you know, so I don't know.
Right.
So, but it caught my attention, and that's the good thing about, you know, using popular icons to catch people's attention.
Right.
So
I love the idea it was sitting in the Smithsonian for 40 years and someone, you know, just found it. But, you know, when we toured the collections there, there were so many items that, you know, were collected last century and still are waiting to be, you know, written about and discussed. And
you know, when they come across those fossil sites, they're so rich that they're just stuff. And there's all kinds of things that were dug out of that site in Texas. And it goes to a proper collection place so the scientists can then come along. And so this was a postdoc. I don't have his name in front of me that discovered it. And there's two authors on the paper, which
is
very cool.
I remember going to the Cooper down in Orange County.
In Orange County. It's the repository for all the stuff they bump into in the highways.
What's it called, though?
I think it's called the Cooper Center or something like
that. Right, the Cooper Center. I remember seeing rows and rows in this shed of plaster jacketed cetacean bones. And I asked the guy, I said, so how many years are you talking here to get through this? He went, generations.
Generations. And
that means there'll be grandchildren will be working on this stuff.
There are jobs to be done, you know. So at the Smithsonian, you've been in the back rooms there. There's just acres of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, cool stuff.
So hey, in preparing for our guest today, who is he a doctor? Dr. Edward
Davis? He is Dr. Edward Davis. He's also known as Dr. Pronghorn.
You sent me in your fantastic homework that you sent me for this episode. There were a couple of research papers that I think you and I both agreed after reading them, they made our heads hurt.
There were lots and lots of research papers
on
this.
Why does that make our heads hurt? They're dense.
They're dense.
We're
they're
not
technical.
Academics. Well, I'm not. Maybe you're more than I am, but I figured out a way. I've cracked it.
What? You figured out a way?
I've cracked how to read these things.
Because I kind of know paleo and I get lost. Dave, what
are
you doing?
I've got the answer. And this is, I'm going to share this with all of you listeners. If you have trouble reading a research paper, copy it, throw it into ChatGPT or any other language learning model, learning language, LLM, right? And then ask it to summarize it into an introduction, a body, and a conclusion into three paragraphs. And I took huge, dense research
paper.
And I got basically an awesome summary. And if it still is too dense, say, summarize it as though I'm a high school student. And if you can't even understand it from there, say, summarize it like I'm a five-year-old.
So it spits back a couple paragraphs that summarizes everything? You tell it to do that.
It spit back three very dense paragraphs that were less dense than the research paper, but with nomenclature and explanations that I could understand.
So maybe people could actually do that with our podcast.
What?
Well, you know, I run into people that say very often, well, you know, I love the show, but all that, you know, scientific jargon, I don't get it, you know. So maybe they could just copy and paste everything we say.
Well, I have an answer to that. Go to our website and you can click on all the hundreds of Wikipedia links that I, you know, as I edit these episodes, I go, oh, what is a synthetoceras? Yeah, how do you pronounce it?
I don't know. Actually, what is?
Yeah. So I go to Wikipedia. Synthetoceras. And you'll find, what? Synthetoceras?
Synthetoceras.
Okay. You will find that Wikipedia page in the link on our guest's episode webpage at paleonerds.com. So I do the research for you.
You know, Dave, I'm really happy that you found a workaround and all that. It's pretty cool. But hey,
well, hopefully we'll be able to read these research papers with more clarity and not get headaches.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting solution.
Hooray, who's our guest today?
Hey, our guest today is Ed Davis. He's a paleontologist. Let's call him up. He's in Eugene, Oregon.
But what are we going to talk about? Are we going to talk about headgear and pronghorn antelopes?
Headgear, pronghorns, and all kinds
headgear,
of stuff.
Headgear, I mean, we're not talking football helmets. We're talking the amazing diversity of antlers and
antlered beasties from the past.
Let's get into this.
Call a guy that knows. Call him up on the old phone, will you, dude?
Okay.
Hey, Dave, meet Ed Davis. He's a vertebrate paleontologist and an associate professor of earth sciences at the University of Oregon, where he is also director of the Thomas Compton Fossil Collections at the UO Museum of Natural and Cultural History. Hey, Ed, thanks for joining us, man, to meet Dave.
Hey, Ed, nice to see you.
Nice to meet you, Dave. Thanks. It's good to see you again, Ray.
Yeah, you guys go way back, right?
Yeah, we go way back, and we're working on a thing. But I think first off, we need to ask you.
So I saw you have a YouTube channel where you are unboxing watches, fixing your 1977 Jeep,
and cracking
a safe with your son, which is pretty awesome. But are you a paleo nerd, Ed, and how?
Yeah, am I a paleo nerd? The answer is yes. And I've been a paleo nerd since before Jurassic Park, but Jurassic Park is what made me believe that I could actually make a life out of it.
Oh.
Yeah, so I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, going to the Pink Palace Museum, which that has a wonderful history all on its own. But at the Pink Palace Museum, they had extensive exhibits about the fossil history of the Mid-South, that area around Memphis, and got me excited about paleontology as a little kid. And then once I saw Jurassic Park, I was like, well, what can I do to actually get involved? And I started as a museum volunteer there in high school. So that's where I got my start.
That's volunteering. Cool. What are the fossils in Tennessee? Are they marine?
Yeah, it's marine. So a lot of what I worked on was Mississippi embayment, Mesozoic marine fossils.
Right.
So there's a whole series of sites in sort of central Tennessee that are Mississippi embayment, sort of Cretaceous stuff. And I got some work with a lot of marine invertebrates from those sites. Not a lot of vertebrates got preserved in those sediments, but a few did. And then there's a lot of like Pleistocene stuff from West Tennessee. Sorry, I'm talking over you, Ray.
So when you saw Jurassic Park, you were a teenager and you started volunteering at the museum, and that's how it all started?
That's how it all started. I saw Jurassic Park and it was real transformative. I saw that movie, and when I came out of the first showing, I was all, either I'm going to be a professional special effects artist or I'm going to be a professional paleontologist. And I immediately started digging around in Memphis, like, what, where can I get experience in one of these two areas? And in Memphis, I could volunteer at the museum and be a paleontologist, but there was no opportunities to do movie special effects. So that kind of fell by the wayside. Yeah.
And one thing led to another, and off to school you went. You got your degree. You went to Berkeley for your PhD, I believe.
That's right. I went to school at the University of Tennessee, and there was no dinosaur paleontology to be done there. I did
dinosaurs.
Invertebrate paleontology undergraduate thesis on the Ordovician Martinsburg formation of East Tennessee. I still have a piece of it from my undergraduate thesis on my trophy shelf here in my office. And then I went off to graduate school at Berkeley, and I wanted to be a dinosaur paleontologist, but it was not to be. So all those, yeah. And I think that listeners to your podcast by now have understood that there is a friendly rivalry between mammal paleontology and dinosaur paleontology.
I would like to call it friendly, but yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'd like to call it friendly. We pretend it's friendly. And people really line up on one side or the other. You're either a dinosaur paleontologist or you're a mammal paleontologist, but there are not a lot of people who cross that line.
Well, now, wait a minute. What about the bivalve people?
Well, you know, like we all love, like bless their hearts, the invertebrate paleontologists there out there. Yeah. And we all value the people who do paleobotany, and the palynologists are their own like whole world. And as a mammal paleontologist, I am indebted to the work that all the palynologists do to understand paleoclimate and paleoenvironments.
Did you say, palynologists as in pollen?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
They're called pollenologists or what?
Yeah, palynology.
Oh, palynology
is the study of ancient pollen, and you know that gets lumped in with like spores.
Yeah.
And evidence for ancient fires.
But a lot
and stuff.
Of ecosystems can be completely described just by the pollen.
By the pollen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not to mention, you know, the paleobotanists too.
Right. Yeah.
So at Berkeley, you went there dinosaur loving, and they turned you to mammals. What happened?
That's right.
There?
I know. I applied to work with Kevin Padian, and bless his heart, Kevin decided that I was not the right material for his research lab. But Tony Barnosky saw my application and said, "Yes, Edward can work with me." And Tony tried to let me have space to work on fossil reptiles and amphibians from the Cenozoic, because Tony's a Cenozoic paleontologist. His focus is on small mammals, rodents from the Cenozoic. A lot of his work has been in that area. But in the end, I got really excited about fossil mammals on the larger scale. Part of it was that I had undiagnosed strabismus. So that's an eye disorder.
What?
That causes your two eyes to not be able to completely align properly. And it's funny how these things can shape your whole career, but I tried my best to work with the binocular microscopes on fossil micro mammals.
Oh, wow.
I tried my best, but I could never actually resolve two images into a single image using the binocular microscope.
Wow, so a physical limitation diverted you yet again.
Exactly. And so I had to give up on any hope that I was going to work with fossil rodents. And I got really excited about fossil amelocaprids. Actually, that's my true love.
What is it? What's that?
Pronghorns.
Yeah, amelocaprids are the pronghorn antelope, right?
Aha. Okay.
Yeah, so there's only one species alive today, only found in North America. It's the fastest land animal in North America, and it's the symbol of the American Society of Mammalogists, so the folks who study living mammals. They use that animal as their symbol. And it turns out that like a lot of interesting large mammals, there's a whole diversity of them that are extinct today. So you can say the same thing about horses. There's only a few species of horses still around today. There's like the domestic horse and some zebras and some asses and so forth. But a huge diversity of extinct horses. Same with rhinos. There's only the two rhinos alive today, but when we look in the Miocene of North America, we have a diversity of rhinos. Well, pronghorn antelope actually occupied a lot of the niches that we see African antelope occupy in Africa today, but in the Miocene and Pliocene in North America.
Yeah, I have a question. And it's basically, there's only one species of pronghorn, but there was an incredible evolutionary diversification for the last since the Miocene, correct?
Yeah, actually.
Why did they all radiate and then vanish into one species?
That is a great question, and that is if I have an answer to it before I die, I'll feel like I did something.
So it's unknown.
Yeah, we don't have a great answer to it. And in fact, yeah. Go ahead, Ray.
Well, there's one thing that I was wondering, and Kirk and I have talked about this a little bit, that you said that the pronghorns, they're a great symbol, great American symbol, found only in North America. Did cheetahs actually evolve in North America? They're the fastest, you know, predator out there. And there was this discussion of
we're talking about pronghorns. I know there's plenty of your questions, but how does this relate to the different diversification
it
of
gets
pronghorns
into,
and they don't?
It gets into the speed of cheetahs driving the evolution of pronghorns.
So predator prey.
The predator is no longer there,
right?
But they are outrunning a predator that is no longer there, like a ghost predator.
Yeah, so like there's actually a paper by Robert Bakker, another bless his heart fella. Robert Bakker is mostly known for his dinosaur paleontology, but back in the 80s.
He's been on our podcast.
He has been on your podcast. Okay, I didn't do all my homework. I listened to a number of your recent podcasts to know exactly what I was going to get into here, but I haven't found the Robert Bakker episode yet. But he's mostly known for his dinosaur paleontology work, but back in the 80s, I guess, he published a paper, I think it's called The Ghost of Competition Past. And in that paper, he posited the idea that the modern pronghorn speed was left over, as Ray has intimated, from a competition with the cheetah. So when we look at the fossil record of North America, we find fossils of this animal that we like to call the North American cheetah-like cat.
Okay.
Yeah, because
it's the American lion? Is that Pantheris?
No, it's a different species from the American lion. And I got American lion research we're working on, too, that I can talk about later if you want. But the cheetah-like cat, it seems like what I've read that convinces me so far is that the cheetah-like cat is an independent evolution of the cheetah ecological role that comes from the puma, which is another North American cat that's still around today. And it looks like the modern African cheetah, its ancestors are actually closely related to the puma as well. So we can consider this North American cheetah-like cat and the actual African cheetah to be kind of a parallel evolution, you know.
Oh, parallel.
Where the,
okay.
Where they have the ancestor has a lot of traits that are in a space where evolving into this high-speed pursuit predator is easy.
Did the cheetah evolve in North America and then radiate to Africa?
No, as far as I can tell, there's two separate cheetah evolutionary events, right? Like, and not to get too tangled up in this, but at this point, there's a lot of evidence that like flight evolved multiple times in dinosaurs, right? We're starting to have to accept this idea. And I think that this is what happens a lot in evolution is that you've got organisms that have traits that put them in a space where they could explore new niches, and then multiple different lineages end up sort of falling into that new niche space. And so that's what I think has happened here, where you've got the cheetah evolving, and then you've also got this miracinonyx, the cheetah-like cat, evolving these same traits. So it's clear the North American one had the same kind of springy ligaments for going really fast. It lost a retraction of claws in parallel with the African cheetah. Something to do with speed means that you can't retract your claws.
Wow.
And it probably even had the same kind of retae for heat, you know, transfer to protect its brain from overheating as it runs really fast. And we find these cheetah-like cats in the fossil record of a number of places, like Natural Trap Cave, I think, has some really good representations. What's interesting is they're not at Rancho La Brea. They're not in the tar pits. But that actually matches. So if you looked at Blair Van Valkenburg's research group, did some
but
studies.
But La Brea is only 40,000. La Brea is recent.
Yeah. So, well, but this cat is relatively recent too.
Oh.
Yeah, it only went extinct. It was before the big wave of megafaunal extinctions,
right.
But it's not that old. But like in Africa, anyway, so it makes sense that it's not Rancho La Brea. And so, you know, there's this idea that the pronghorn speed is a consequence of it being, you know, like in Africa, the Thompson's gazelle and the cheetah are locked in this evolutionary arms race where they're trying to get faster to get away from the cheetah. The gazelle is, and the cheetah is trying to get faster to keep catching the gazelle. And maybe that was happening with the pronghorn antelope and this North American cheetah-like cat. And it's possible. That's possible. But one of the things that's important not to lose track of is that the pronghorn that lives today has actually, its speed has been captured by sexual selection. And so in the end, its high speed today could be seen the same as like the really long tail on the widow birds or those eyes that are really far out on the stalk-eyed flies where sexual selection catches a trait and then it starts to go really crazy. So when pronghorn antelope males compete with one another, the way that they have sexual selection.
Do they run fast past their suitors?
Yeah, so they're what we call male-male competition. So the males control territories, and then the females free range. So they're not like harems like some kinds of animals do with male-male competition, where there's direct competition for control of a particular group of females. Yeah. The pronghorn control territories, and the females move freely. And so when the males are competing for territories, they don't fight with their horns. They actually kind of do this ritualized display. And sometimes one of them will say, okay, yeah, you're like more manly than me, and give up in the ritualized display phase. But if they think that their horns are similar in size, then they'll actually have a race. The two males will actually run.
Now that's pretty wild.
On your mark, get set.
Yeah. And whoever's faster is the one who gets to keep the territory.
Hey guys, before we get into the smoked salmon spread, which you guys, I want to talk about.
I want to talk about that.
And you'll know what I mean in a second. Why was there such a diversity of headgear with the pronghorns, and it's now down to one style?
Yeah. Well, I think the diversity of headgear, there's a lot of research on African antelopes that suggests that the headgear is tied into the mode of male competition, and that's tied into the herd structure of the species overall. So when you have like small animals that pair up individually, they have different kinds of headgear and different kinds of competition. When you have really big animals like bison or a real buffalo, they compete in a different way. And there were some of these pronghorn that were getting big into that bison buffalo kind of category. And there were some of them that were tiny in the like hiding in the woods category. And so the headgear then evolves to reflect the way that the animals are interacting with one another.
So it's a function of social interaction, really?
I think so. I think it's like a crystallized behavior.
And what about a megaloceros?
Isn't that the Irish elk with the huge antlers?
Yeah.
Irish elk have a 12-foot antler span, which is insane. What is that about?
I think that's runaway sexual selection again. I think that part of it is, like, really runaway sexual selection usually is in a female choice category, where the females are choosing the males based on physical characteristics.
Color, yeah.
And
yeah,
often like the peacock or the widow birds. And so what I think may have happened, like a lot of deer today, it's male-male competition where they're fighting, they're pushing the antlers against one another. But it may be that with the Irish elk, and they're extinct, so we can't be sure. But if the females were choosing males on the basis of how broad their antlers were, then all of a sudden there's a real strong sexual selection for outrageously broad antlers.
Right.
And, you know, evolutionarily that shows the females, well, if he can survive with these huge antlers, then he must have good genes to be healthy enough for everything else, right? And the problem is that at some point those sexually selected traits get to be so extreme.
Right.
That they actually do hurt the animals, and that's probably what happened with them, is that they were growing these antlers so fast that they were pulling calcium out of their bones and out of their bloodstream, and they're actually having like calcium crises, which can cause you to have a heart attack. Like if you have low calcium,
really?
Like your autonomous nervous system that runs your smooth muscles can give up, and you can just die. And
it seems like you'd be easy prey then for predators if you're so unwieldy with this 12-foot rack, you know?
Yeah.
You can't run through a forest.
Right. You have to really pick your path through the forest. Your body's shutting down and you're having problems like with your muscles working properly. Yeah, exactly. So at that point, the sexual selection's gone too far. And there should be stabilizing selection, but it may be that in their case, it was, you know, there wasn't enough time, there wasn't enough individuals, and they just went extinct.
back to the original question, and then I want to get into the four types of bone growth. And at my local Baskin Robbins, I just had an ossicone. Thank you. Thank you very much. So anyway, yeah, we'll talk about what an ossicone is. Why do you think, we'll wrap it up there.
Yeah, why is there only one of them left today?
Yeah. Yes.
Because it's like that in so many of these groups of large mammals, it almost makes you wonder if there's not a common cause for why you would have diversity in the Miocene and Pliocene and then collapsing to a single kind today. And with the pronghorn, you can't point to the megafaunal extinction of 20,000 years ago because most of them were extinct before that. And I think part of it has to do with that North American transition from a forested landscape to a grassland and forest landscape. And there was this moment when you had a lot of patchiness, you had more in a woodland where you'd have some forest and some grassland, and it creates a lot of additional complex habitats for animals to live in. And as that evaporated and you got to where you either had forest or you had grassland, a lot of those habitats, were gone. And so the ecosystems had to simplify, and you lost a lot of that diversity.
So simplification of the ecosystems caused the headgear to minimize.
Well, yeah, at least in North America. And I mean, if you look in Africa, you still have all this diversity of form, but North America, is more, it's further north, further from the equator. And so as a consequence, you don't have tropical habitats. You have temperate and boreal habitats. And so they just, I think, in the end, you don't have the energy, the primary productivity to create that complex and ecosystem. So part of it may have to do with overall Cenozoic global cooling. So through the Miocene into the Pliocene and Pleistocene, you've got this just general cooling overall. That favors grassland habitats, and maybe that the grasslands are also contributing to some of that cooling process.
I'm wondering too, if habitats open up, maybe there's a more of a hybridizing kind of thing that also happens too, as species are kind of moving apart but then melding back together.
There's certainly more room for hybridization and the loss of diversity than modern cladistic thinking will let us accept.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've heard you guys talk a little bit before about cladistics and phylogenetic systematics and the way that we try to understand the tree of life. Right. And the methods that we use today don't really leave any space for hybridization and the loss of diversity by branches coming back together.
Well, I mean, and with humans, 200,000 years ago, there were several species of us. Did we just completely separate, or was there really this interweaving and,
right,
and
exactly. hybridizing? You know, and we can look at like grizzly bears and polar bears. They look like really different species, but their diversity is coming back together. And it may be that in the end we lose polar bears in part because they merge back into the overall diversity of grizzly bears. So yeah, I think there's space for that in the history of life too. It's just more difficult for us to model it with the current techniques that we use. And then, in the history of science, like that kind of technique limitation often blinds us to important directions. So as we move forward, hopefully some younger, clever people will come up with new ways for us to model these things, and we can have a bigger appreciation for the history of life.
When you get the grizzlies and the polar bears, you get a pizzly, I guess.
That's what they call them, pizzly bears. And then
pizzly bears.
They're not really great at either of those ecological roles. They, like polar bears, have fur on their pads of their feet to protect them from the ice. But the pizzly bears are white, but then some of them don't have those pads on their feet. And so the ice can hurt them.
So the pizzly grizzly is actually a polar bear. It's still white, but it's got the brown bear trait starting to show up.
Yeah. And I mean, it's of course, it's when you hybridize, like dominant traits and recessive traits start to interact. And so, like your first gen might look more like a polar bear, but your second gen might look more like a grizzly bear, depending.
Is there a pizzly bear, or are you guys?
This is a legit thing, and a lot of the biologists.
There is a pizzly bear, but actually, you know what? Maybe this is a good little pivot,
yeah.
if I may. In the Great Lakes, there are Chinook salmon that are breeding now with pink salmon, oh. and they are called Pinooks.
Oh, man.
Really?
Yeah. So they are completely, they're not sister species. They're in the same genus.
You is that think because that they we opened the St. Lawrence Seaway, or is this a natural phenomenon?
No, well, it's a kind of an unnatural thing because they've been throwing salmon and introducing Pacific right. salmon into the Great Lakes where right. They don't go to the ocean.
Yeah.
They go out there in the lakes, they mess around, and next right. thing you know, you've got a Pinook salmon.
Sport fishermen then. Yeah.
yeah.
Because do you want to talk about salmon and then go back to horns?
No. Go. Take it back. Go.
All right. Just that I dove into those research papers that Ray submitted your name is attached to.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that there were these four types of bone growth.
Well, for headgear, yeah.
For headgear. One of them is straight bone, comes straight out of the skull.
Yeah.
Then there is the ornaments that are on giraffids. I didn't even know there was something called a giraffid.
Yeah. Giraffids is actually, I mean, that's another group, right? There's only the two that are alive today. There's the giraffe and
the weird looking oki. What's it called?
The okapi.
Okapi.
And the okapi is like a short necked giraffe. It's actually got like zebra stripes on half its body. Is found only in really deep tropical forests in Africa. And it's cool, I think, in part because it's got these ossicones like a giraffe. So they're bumps on its head. They're like horn-like, but they don't have horns. To be a real horn, you have to have something that's like a hoof-like keratinous covering. You can think of a mountain goat.
Define an ossicone compared to an antler.
Right, so an ossicone giraffes and okapi have is a bony growth out of their head, but it's covered in just skin and fur, right? So you think of
bleeds if you cut it?
Bleeds if you cut it. And with okapi, what's kind of crazy is they hit each other, and they hit, I guess, things in their environment hard enough with these ossicones that they actually tear the skin back and expose the sharp tip of the bone inside, and then it just stays there like a knife on its head. And so
wow.
the okapi just like will walk around and live their lives with these bones that are attached to the part of its skeleton sticking out of the top of its head, like a little knife ready to stab somebody that messes with it. Yeah.
Is there a scab or some
yeah,
sort
they'll have
of
basically
a
like a wound, like a partially healed wound in a circle around the place where the bone sticks out. You can imagine it's kind of like a compound fracture that just
yeah.
never gets pushed back
in. I was going to say that on your arm walking around.
Yeah, exactly. I can't imagine.
With your ulna sticking out.
Right. Like you worry about it being a real source of infection, but apparently they just live their lives that way. What's interesting to me is that there are extinct members of that pronghorn antelope group that seem to have done this too, but in an even more complex way. They would basically grow like deer antlers. Right? Complex branching structures on their heads. The skin would die back, so the bone is all exposed. And then it would just stay like that for the rest of their lives. So it would not, like deer drop their antlers and grow new ones every year. So I guess to for your listeners, the four kinds of headgear. So you've got the ossicones, like giraffes have, that are very simple and just bony protrusions with just skin over them. You've got horns, like you see in the bovid group, so the cows and their relatives, like goats. They have bony protrusions from their heads that are covered with a horn.
Right, with a sheath.
Well,
right,
horn
the
sheath.
Keratinous.
It's the same material as like fingernails.
Right.
Or actually very similar to the hooves of those animals. And it stays for their whole lives. They grow new keratinous horn material every year. Then you've got the deer have antlers, and antlers are exposed bone, but it grows a rack of antlers once a year, and then it sheds it and heals over the spot where the antlers came out. And then you've got the pronghorn, like the modern pronghorn antelope. It grows a keratinous sheath, a lot like a horn, but then at the end of the mating season, that falls off. And then it has what's left over looks a lot like an ossicone. It's just a bony protrusion that's covered in fur-covered skin. And it
so
grows
kind
a
of
new
like the pulp remains?
Well, sort of, yeah. I mean, the skin that was underneath the horn stays, and when the horn is shed, it's got a fur that's grown on it, and it sort of stays like that during the off season. And then when the mating season's about to begin the next year, it grows a new horny sheath all over again.
Is it bigger than last year, and maybe has one more prong, or no?
No. They always have the one prong.
Right.
It looks like a fireplace poker. And yeah, as it grows the first few years, it'll be bigger each year, but it kind of reaches a maximum size. But like with deer, like what you're suggesting, with deer, they grow the antlers and they sort of add a new spike every year that they grow their antlers until they get to be about 5 or 6 years old. And then there's actually, if the deer lives long enough, it gets to be an old man deer, it actually goes through what we call antler senescence, and the antlers it grows are smaller every year. Yeah. So there's a sweet spot for the deer that's about 5 or 6 years old where it has its biggest rack. And if it lives to be an old man deer, then it grows smaller racks.
And do one of these types of headgear are able to be planted on bone and grow like coral can?
Yeah. So with the deer antlers, because they shed them every year, it's actually really fascinating. They,
it's a stem cell, right? A bone stem cell?
Yeah, so the pedicle, the base of the antlers, retains stem cells. And then when the hormones change for the next mating season and it grows the new antlers, those stem cells actually grow the antlers out a lot like how plants grow. So you'll have like an apical piece that's growing the point, the tips of the antlers. And then the bone that's left behind grows out sideways to fill out the diameter of the antler. And while it's growing, the antlers are covered in very thin skin called velvet. And that skin has to be there to protect the bone as it grows. But once the antlers reach their maximum size for the year, the velvet dies.
It shreds and falls off.
But what's really interesting is that we know now that in the core of those antlers are still living bone cells, actually, for a lot of that mating season. So those antlers you see on the deer are actually living bone, and it's, you know, part of the skeleton. So again, it's like a compound fracture. When that velvet dies back, that's exposed bone sticking out of the head of this animal. And,
really?
And then they use them to fight with one another. Yeah. And then they shed them at the end of the season. And there's actually, you know, an interesting scientific question. Well, number one, like why do they grow them? Well, you can say they grow them to have these fights. Okay. Like, and if a deer with antlers defends itself against a person, it will sometimes use the antlers to gore you, but it's actually more likely to use its hooves to gore you because they don't seem to think of them as like,
weapons,
they think of them as like they are there to have these fights with the other male deer, right? And so that's why it's there. But why does it fall off? Why do they lose them at the end of the season? And, you know, one idea is because it's actually a vector for disease to get into the body is having this, you know, skeleton piece exposed. And so having them come off and heal over reduces that chance of infection.
Could it be resource management for the winter?
I actually think that's a better idea because the other thing about antlers is that they're like a giant heat sink, right? It's like we're told as humans that we should wear a hat in the winter because you lose so much heat through your head. Well, imagine if instead of wearing a hat, you had like a giant radiator attached to your head to cool you even faster. Yeah. And so by losing the antlers, they reduce that heat loss to the surface area of the antlers in the wintertime.
But I meant the production of calcium or to keep the thing going through the winter.
Well, you know, it doesn't really grow a lot. Like once the velvet comes off, it does add a little bit of density to the center of the antlers, but most of the calcium use is gone by the time the velvet comes off. I mean, in a way, it would be better evolutionarily for them to just grow one really big rack of antlers one time and then hold on to them because then they don't have to keep every year. Those deer bucks have to go out and eat enough calcium resources to grow another rack, right?
What is the evolutionary relationship between all of these animals and the headgear? Is it the ruminants that kind of tie them together and that whole group radiated out and they all have that trigger to have headgear, that paper?
Yeah. So the idea is that these are all different parts of the ruminant artiodactyls. There's a couple of ruminant groups that don't have headgear, but most of them have one form or another of these things on their heads. And what we proposed in our paper was that that maybe there's some kind of evolutionary predisposition, kind of like we were talking about before with the cheetah-like cat, where these things all evolved in parallel because their common ancestor had something that that lent itself to having these headgear. And maybe that common ancestor actually had like ossicones like a giraffe. And then that got co-opted and changed into one group has horns and one group has antlers and one group has a pronghorn. But the problem is that we don't have a lot of fossils from that time. They seem to have diversified really quickly. And so because of the speed of that diversification and the, you know, the fragmentary nature of the fossil.
Was that in the Eocene? What is the first mammalian ancestor of the ruminants? Is it in the Eocene?
I think that probably these animals, were diversifying in the Eocene.
So 40 million years ago.
Right. I mean, pronghorn seemed to just appear fully formed in the North American record at the beginning of the Miocene, or the latest part of the Oligocene. And so one of the big problems for pronghorn paleontology is, where do they come from? And
the paleontologists or the pronghorns?
Well, yeah, we don't have a lot of people who are pronghorn paleontologists. That's
right.
True, but
they're extinct.
Yeah, we're not extinct yet. Yeah,
how many of them are there, Ed? Besides you, is there a group of you that hang out together, talk pronghorn?
There's actually a bigger group of ruminant paleontologists that they get together at conferences and things and talk about stuff,
and ruminate.
Yeah, as far as people who are focusing on pronghorns, there's probably only half a dozen or fewer people in the world, I think.
Well, I'm just blown away when I look at some of the old paleo books from the Age of Mammals and just the sheer diversity, the wackiness. Synthetoceros is, am I saying that correctly? Is the sort of Y-shaped
thing on
the
nose. It's got its nose. Yeah.
Oh, it's a slingshot, right?
Yeah. Slingshot. Is that in the group too? Is it a...
Ruminant? No, I think Synthetoceros is actually, isn't it? My memory is, well, number one, some of these things are hard to place because there's a lot of sort of parallel evolution of traits. And so there's arguments about where to put some of the fossil ones that we don't have DNA for, right? But my memory is that Synthetoceros is in one of these groups that's just outside the true ruminants and put more with the camels. So, yeah, don't quote me on that.
I was looking at some cladograms and it did seem to sit outside of it.
That's one of those ones where like there's several of these things like Dromomerix is the one that's Dromomerix like a deer like? But with ossicones.
Meaning
from how
what?
Long ago? Exactly.
From the Miocene in North America.
Right.
Yeah. And
so it's a an earlier ancestor,
well,
perhaps.
It may be a ruminant. It may be closer to camels. There's arguments about where to put it in the evolutionary tree, because.
Well, wait. Go back and define ruminant. That's something with several stomachs.
Yeah.
To ruminate their food.
Yeah. So true ruminants,
grazers,
are in the group that include, you know, like cows and deer that actually chew cud, right?
Right.
And so true ruminants have a set of complex, they're not really stomachs, they're chambers in the stomach. And what they'll do is they'll eat their grass or their forage, they'll eat their plants and digest it once, and then it comes back up as cud, as partially digested,
cud.
And then they chew it some more, and that's what we call rumination.
But I realized today in studying this that I now know what an artiodactyl is, an animal that has all its weight bearing on two of the toes, while the other three either become anterior or are on the side or even melt away as little nubs. But are ruminants artiodactyls, or are they also, can they be perissodactyls, which are the odd-toed,
right,
hoofed mammals?
Like horses and rhinos. No, so ruminantia is based on both morphology and now DNA evidence. Ruminantia is a monophyletic group that falls within the Artiodactyla.
Okay. Yeah.
So they are
kind of one and the same.
Well, Artiodactyl is a bigger group. It includes things like pigs and camels and apparently right. now whales.
Yep.
Yeah, and hippopotami.
All right, right. So hippopotamus and whales are still close.
Yeah, hippopotamus right? and whales are close. I have a whole lot of a lot of feelings about that one.
Oh, you do?
Well, just to remind everybody, whales were land animals with four legs and hair.
Yeah, once upon a time, yeah.
Ambulocetus and Pachycetus.
Right,
and
exactly.
All that.
I don't dispute any of the fossil record or the DNA evidence about the whale hippo relationship. One of the things I'm curious about, and I don't see enough people researching, is people will just make the assertion that the traits that hippos have for being semi-aquatic are directly related to the traits that the whale ancestors had for being semi-aquatic. And the little bit of the fossil record of hippos that I've seen suggests to me that that's another example of parallel evolution.
Right.
Where the
right,
common
right,
ancestor
right.
of whales and hippos was a land animal. And then those two lineages in parallel evolved traits to be semi-aquatic.
Yeah. In one of your YouTube shorts, you're holding up these two giant toe bones. So it has to be an extinct
Well, actually, that was not extinct. No, unfortunately, we don't have giraffes up here. It's a camel.
It's a camel.
Yeah.
That was a camel foot. Thank you, Ray.
Yeah.
Winner.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of paleo collections have modern animal bones, to use to compare. So like we have all these fossil camels that are mostly broken up little pieces. So we have several modern camel skeletons from zoos and things that we use to try to figure out what pieces we've got. And those are two, camel feet that were preserved with the ligaments still intact. So all the toes and the wrist and ankle bones are still in articulation, and that can be really useful for teaching those elements to students. Yeah.
Well, you know, I wanted to ask you just a little bit about the Thomas Condon fossil collection. There are a number of camels.
Wait, that's the namesake of your research lab?
Yeah, the fossil collection there.
Yeah, so Thomas Condon, Condon was a pioneer who came to Oregon actually as a minister of the Congregationalist faith. But that particular Christian denomination really focuses on using science as a way to understand how God thinks about the world. And so he was really highly trained as a scientist as well. And when fossils started to be discovered in Eastern Oregon, he got really involved and eventually became the state geologist. And then when the University of Oregon was founded, he became the first science faculty member at the University of Oregon. Yeah.
So did his actual collection start the collection there?
Yes. Yeah. So we have like 80% of the fossils that he had when he was alive.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Was he a John Day fossil guy?
Yeah. He collected a lot at John Day fossil beds. And in fact, Thomas Condon sent a number of fossil horse specimens east.
There you go. Yeah.
Did you want to tell the story, Ray?
Yeah, I saw the YouTube video about it, that he's the guy who said, oh, wait, this is a horse fossil. And it's like, that's what it occurred to folks. Like, wait a minute, horses were in North America. They were here first, you know.
They evolved here.
Right.
They evolved here. But he was the guy that realized that.
Yeah, he's the one who figured it out. And when Huxley was visiting Marsh, there were a bunch of the fossils that Thomas Condon had sent in the lab. And so when Huxley made a lot of his diagrams talking about horse evolution to try to sell Darwin's idea to people in popular culture, the fossils of horses that he was drawing from were ones that Thomas Condon had collected in Oregon.
Oh.
So
are horses artiodactyls? Is that hoof?
Horses are pericidactyls.
Pericidactyls. Oh,
okay. Yeah, because they have this is their one toe.
Both of you are giving me the finger now.
No, it's a horse.
You guys are giving me the finger. I'm really hurt.
No, this is a horse.
So the middle finger is the horse's hoof.
Yeah.
They run around on that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So, yeah. But Thomas Kahn, did he collect camels? That's my segue there. Was
oh, yeah. I think there are some camel fossils in with all the other stuff he collected. He was the first one that collected John Day, and he sent all those fossils back east. A lot of them went to O.C. Marsh, and then Marsh refused to send them back to Thomas Condon. Condon had said they were loans, and they needed to come back to Oregon for the state's heritage. And Marsh kept them. They're still at the Peabody Museum, as I understand it.
Huh.
And then, when Thomas Condon discovered fossils at this place we call Fossil Lake, which is a much later site, it's like a Pleistocene site that has camels, he told that to, Marsh's rival, Cope. And so Cope got the scoop on Fossil Lake. And so the first, papers on Fossil Lake were published by Cope because Marsh, was not kind to Thomas Condon, and did not return his fossils.
Oh. So the Marsh-Cope fight even made it to Oregon.
It did indeed, yeah. Wow. And we have the connection there. In our museum, we actually have on exhibit a compass, a pocket compass that Thomas Condon used, that on the back of it is inscribed to the Reverend Thomas Condon from O.C. Marsh. So Marsh had given this compass to Condon when he came out to Oregon to visit the sites, yeah.
You gentlemen have very exciting news that I want to hear about this, and it is basically what's on my bagel and cream cheese.
It's also hanging on the wall behind you.
It is hanging on the wall behind me right here.
Yeah. I saw that. I saw you got the giant salmon behind you there.
So yeah, that's an earlier version, which, you know, I've followed that salmon for a long time, and we talked about it a little bit on other shows.
The spike-toothed salmon. The saber-toothed salmon.
I've been calling it spike-toothed, hoping that that'll stick. But, Ed, for our listeners who may not have heard that before, can you give us the story? And I want to hear from you as to how this all came about, how it was found, and then how our interpretation of it changed.
Okay, yeah. So there's this fossil salmon, this giant fossil salmon, from the Miocene of the Pacific Coast. And my understanding is that for decades, paleontologists had been finding pieces of it in the fossil record. They knew it was a giant salmon, but the pieces were too scrappy to name a new species from it, which is surprising because that usually doesn't stop people. But I've seen fossils of it that were collected down in the Bay Area back in the early part of the 20th century. And so in the, I guess the 1950s, local folks in the town of Gateway, Oregon found giant salmon fossils coming out of the local gravel quarry. And so they called in the University of Oregon paleontology folks, who came over and excavated partial skeleton, including a mostly complete skull of this giant extinct salmon.
And how big?
How big? More than 2 meters long. So more than
6 feet.
More than 6 feet. Yeah.
I've worked with Jerry Smith on that. We talked about it. He gives it an easy 8 feet. And I was like, I think it could eat. I've seen vertebrae on it huge.
But yes.
400 pounds is what we were guessing. Right. 400 at 8 feet. But go on with the story.
And yeah. Because we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. And so that fossil, like, The paleontologist at Oregon at the time was General Shotwell, and he was a mammal paleontologist like me, not a fish paleontologist. So he sent the fossil off to a collaborator at the University of Michigan, and they published a paper on it. Cavender and Miller published a paper in 1972 in the University of Oregon Bulletin on it, and they named it Smilodonichthys rastrosus. Smilodonichthys being the genus name, and it's a portmanteau where they took Smilodon, which is, you know, the saber-toothed cat, and then ichthys means fish. Yeah, so technically it would translate to what, saber-toothed catfish, which is not great because it's not a catfish, and they're not...
That's funny.
They're not really saber-toothed, so people started calling it the saber-toothed salmon after that paper came out.
Yeah, they loved it.
Smilodonichthys name. And the thing is, it had these teeth on its skull, but that original skull that was collected in the 50s and published in 72, the teeth were disarticulated. They'd broken off. And so they had to reconstruct the skull, and they just assumed that the teeth would point, you know, down like teeth usually point.
Like teeth in a jaw.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And so it looked like, you know, kind of like this saber-toothed cat face. Yeah.
And that's, so enter Ray Troll at that point.
Yeah.
So I've read that paper in the 1980s, but I'd heard there was a second specimen that had, that was in private hands, but go ahead with the story.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And so like, and I've heard about this too, my colleague Eric Gustafson is a retired paleontologist who, sometimes comes in and works at the museum here, has told me about seeing this specimen in the 80s that had the teeth that pointed out to the side instead of down. It had the teeth actually, in articulation in the skull still. But that specimen was in private hands, and I'm sure that your listeners are already familiar with the problem that privately owned specimens can't be ethically used for paleontology research. And so nobody really knew exactly what was going on. So when Ray was drawing pictures of this, right, he had the known specimen that's in the museum here, and then he had the stories about this other specimen. So most of Ray's is the saber-toothed cat looking face, but there's a few you did to hedge your bets. And it's a good thing you did too, because, so scientifically, what else happened in the intervening time was, Jerry Smith at the University of Michigan, working with, his student,
who is a past guest on our show.
Jerry Smith.
Jerry Smith. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, we had Jerry on because I wanted to talk about it.
And I think he passed away. Is that correct?
Yeah. He is deceased.
R.I.P.
Yeah. Yeah. He was a great man, and that was good. I'm glad I got to know him. His student, whose name is escaping me right now.
Ralph Sterley?
Yes. So Sterley and Smith published an evolutionary analysis, a cladistic analysis of the salmon. And they showed that this giant salmon, the so-called saber-toothed salmon, actually fell within the diversity of living Ocherhynchus salmon. And its closest living relative is the sockeye salmon, which is also really just interesting. Like this giant salmon with these really weird teeth comes out of all of these salmon that are alive today that look relatively similar to one another. That's really interesting too, but it meant that name, the Smilodonichthys name, got what we call the parentheses of shame. It got moved from being a true genus to a subgenus.
Did you find this specimen?
And so working with Ray, we built a new exhibit at our museum that opened in 2014, and it had art that showed the salmon with the saber tooth, and we got Gary Staub, the sculptor, made us a full-size saber-toothed salmon with the saber teeth pointing down. And 2 months after the exhibit opened, I went out with a group of paleontologists, and we collected 2 new skulls that showed that the teeth actually stick out sideways. So we had 2 new skulls that were preserved, pressed together. So maybe they were spawning together when they were buried. This is an interesting idea.
I think so. Yes.
And then, when they were prepared by my great, volunteer Pat Ward, he came to me. He's like, you're not going to believe what I found. Cause I didn't know that the skulls were complete when I gave him the Pat to work on it. And the sediment's really soft. So it only took him like part of a day to get through to the teeth.
And he's like,
you're not going to believe this. So we went down and we're staring at these 2 skulls with the teeth sticking out sideways, and we knew the saber-toothed salmon idea was dead.
So is there a paper on this new?
Well, so hopefully this episode comes out after the paper comes out.
This episode is going to air in April 2024, and I hear this could be Ray's first research paper.
Actually, so this is my first actual paper that I'm a co-author on. I helped a lot on the Buzzsaw Shark paper, but it was somewhere in there too. We just finished that exhibit, and then it was like I started getting word about all these new skulls.
Well, congratulations.
There was like we had to get back and start working on it again, but I am part of this paper, and it's coming out very soon, and it should be out actually by the time this is aired.
So let's just say it, the saber-toothed salmon is dead, and the spike tooth is the extinct
The extent, the living extent one. Of it. Well, what? No, the extent of it. Oh, I get it. See where you go with that.
Well, I just like that the journal editors and reviewers let us keep our title.
Which is,
well, I don't remember all the wording, but we talk about it being a newfangled reconstruction.
Newfangled
reconstruction, yeah.
From spikes to sabers, a newfangled reconstruction of Onchorhynchus rostrosus.
Yep.
I suspect it is maybe time that I ask you a certain question.
Yes, okay. Yes, and then I have one question to follow up.
All right.
Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
I want to ask you this very important question, Ed. If you could travel back in time, what exciting epoch, what perfect period, what exquisite era would you want to go back to? And what precisely would you want to see, sir?
So I'm curious if anybody on your podcast has ever said something from human times. Like, I would like to go back to 1920 and pick George Gaylord Simpson's brain about what he thought was going on with horse evolution.
This is a first.
No, so nobody's actually done that?
No. If you'll remember Robert Bacher, when we asked him this, wanted to go back to
World. Oh, he wanted to go see the German dreadnoughts.
The German warships. I'm like, what?
Oh, right. You're right.
But go ahead, Ed.
Yeah, so that's not what I'm going to do. I don't want to see any German warships. And, you know, I'm an old car nut, and I really do love, like, my old cars. But what I would do if I had a time machine is I would go back to the Bay Area of California in the time before European colonization, when there's just the native peoples of California living there, and I would bring with me all the tools I could to sample the mammalogy and the herpetology and the plants. And especially to do surveys of what was living in the bay.
Because
Western scientists didn't start paying attention to the natural history of California until after Western colonists had already just completely screwed everything up. So when I'm trying to do my research comparing the Pleistocene ecosystems of North America to the modern ecosystems of North America, I don't even really have a good baseline of what the modern ecosystem should be. Like, we don't, like, there's so many species of estuary animals that were first described from the San Francisco Bay that actually turn out to be from Southeast Asia or other parts of the world.
Oh, really?
Right. That they, well, this is a new species of something from the San Francisco Bay. Well, actually, it was dropped here. Yeah, from ballast
water. Came over on a Chinese labor ship.
Like, I think, and there's like a bunch of fossil or modern rodents that live in the Coast Range of California and the transverse ranges of California that have extremely limited ranges today. And I think we're extensive and important parts of the ecosystem under the regimes that were maintained by the native peoples of California.
This leads me to my question that I was going to ask you.
But let me ask just real quickly, how far back in time did you want to go? How many years ago?
Like we would put it like, the year 1400. So we'll put it like 600.
Before.
600 years in the past.
Okay.
Yeah.
So my question is based on what you just described, and that is considering the impact of human activities that we've made to ecosystems worldwide, and mostly by habitat destruction and biodiversity loss.
Yeah.
How can we use the insights from our paleo past to be applied to guide conservation strategies in these heavily human impacted areas?
Well, I think the
because
thing
this is what you were just talking about.
Right. So like a lot of my research today is driven by what we call conservation paleobiology principles. And what we want to do is there aren't going to really be any unmanaged ecosystems on Earth as we move forward. Like there's very few places on Earth that, I don't think there's any places on Earth that are untouched by human activity. We're finding microplastics even in the highest Himalayas, you know, ecosystems in the furthest places in the central Nevada are still, you know, impacted by human activity. In Antarctica, we're finding evidence of human activity affecting whatever microbial ecosystems there might be in the ice. So we just have to give up on the idea that there are really, truly wild spaces on Earth. And they're all going to be managed one way or the other. But if we want to let the systems heal, maximally heal, and let diversity to return, well, how does diversity return? Speciation, new species origination, is the only way to get diversity back. Because I don't think we're going to do a lot with de-extinction. I know Robert Bakker is really excited about de-extinction, but I think that's a, I think that's, that there's
you mean
a lot
the mammoth
of,
and the mammoth step idea.
Yeah, I don't think de-extinction is the way that we should be going. I think we should be trying to foster optimal ecosystem function today, and we should be managing ecosystems with an eye towards the processes that shaped wild ecosystems in the past.
So we coax diversity based on how nature created it pre-human destruction?
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, we already know a lot about what we need to have. We need to have a lot of interconnected stuff so that species can move around and sort themselves on the landscape in an optimal way. A lot of my postdoc research was focused on, like, what areas of California fostered the most new species in the Pleistocene. And so we can see that, to go back to my story about the Miocene ecotones, those spaces between or the connections between habitat types are what really foster increasing diversity. So when you look in California, the places where you have the intersection between the desert and the Sierra Nevada range and the transverse ranges and the Central Valley tend to be areas with a lot higher diversity, or at least they should have it. And so, thinking about protecting those areas and managing ecosystems with an eye towards allowing processes to operate that generate species richness, that increase the chances of new species formation.
Well,
I think that's what we need to be doing.
What you said in there, Ed, was protecting those areas. Do you absolutely enforce, having wilderness areas and keeping wilderness, really drawing the line, protecting it? I mean, that's the big issue we're always facing, especially
right.
In Alaska.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing is, like, I don't think that there are any truly wild areas
right.
left. Like, and I know the Alaskans might argue with me, but even in the areas where we're doing minimal management or trying to keep human impact out, there's still management of those areas happening. People are still
right.
deciding about what goes on in
oh.
those areas. And there's still stuff coming in. There's pollution coming in.
Right.
You know, there's the sound of, airplanes when they fly over. There's all kinds of stuff that disturbs these ecosystems.
And what snacks go in the vending machine at the visitor center?
I think that the really critical thing is trying to find ways that we can have habitats that allow wild animals to use those habitats, but also allow people to use them too. So thinking about farmland in a way that the farmland can produce food for people, but also foster habitat for animals that might need it as a space to traverse or even a space to just live in.
I think there's some success with elephants and farming in India.
Yeah, there's
wild
places,
elephants.
Yeah, there's places in the world where people are getting this to happen, and there's a lot of really clever people thinking about how to do it. And so I think that's just what we need to be doing. We need to be not thinking in terms of spaces that are only for people and spaces that are only for wild
sure.
animals and plants, but instead thinking about like making sure that spaces have, that there's room for everything.
Hey, Ed, thank you so much for joining us here on Paleo Nerds. It's always a wild and interesting ride.
We could have gone on and gone on. We just kept going here.
All the topics we go to, we touched on so many things. And it's really an honor to have you here. And, hey, it is an honor. It really is. I want to, from the heart, to be a co-author with you on this paper on Oncorhynchus rastrosus. It really does. It's very cool. It's a very cool.
And we'll have a link to that paper in your episode on Paleo Nerds. Thank you, Ed. It's awesome to meet you. And I want to see you crack that another safe with your son on YouTube.
Well, we did, but we ended up having to grind the door off. So
yeah.
That one was more destructive.
No, I thought he just drilled a hole and the thing popped open.
No, that safe we were able to crack.
Oh, right.
But the next one we actually ended up having to use chisels and hammers and.
Right.
Yeah, I'll put that video together eventually.
Wait a minute. So criminals listening to this could get a lot of good stuff from you.
All right, guys. Ed, it was an awesome pleasure to meet you. And thanks for the headgear talk. I really learned a lot.
I was happy to chat with you guys. And I'm really glad you're doing this. I've been enjoying listening to the other episodes of the podcast. I'm learning a lot
myself.
There's
more coming.
Yeah.
Peace out.
All right. See you later.
Headgear, antler, head ornaments.
And Spike 2 Salmon.
Well, that's really great, you guys. And Ray, congratulations on your first. What does it mean? Does that mean you have a citation now?
Yeah, I can get cited, man. Like, instead of just a cop pulling me over, it's a good citation.
It's a good citation.
Yeah, I'm picking up good citations. Anyways, fun talking with Dr. Pronghorn there. We went deep on Dr.
Well, I really enjoyed going into antlers and bone growth and all that stuff. I didn't realize that it was an open wound.
Yeah.
For those weird
stuff and how they're all related. Yeah. So much to ruminate on. I did a drawing once called the Paleo Deer Hunter's Den. I think I sent you a JPEG of that. And it's just...
Yeah, isn't it a bunch of heads?
It's just a bunch of heads, but, you know, it's a drawing of a guy sitting in his den, the old deer hunter, you know. And, man, if he could do, you know, back in the Miocene, think of all the trophies you could have on your wall.
Sure.
Why you could have a
all the weird.
You could have the slingshot one. You could have an. You know, I was wondering, did Irish elk live at the same time? This is the Megaloceros, Megaloceros. Yes. Did they live at the same time as humans?
Oh yeah, they only died out in the last megafauna, so they were around 10,000 years ago.
So maybe as you quipped, I caught the quip that you made on the side there that maybe they made great coat racks.
There you go. Yeah, I'll have to. I don't know much about that. I'm wondering if they were in Ireland before there were humans in Ireland.
Might have been the case.
I don't really know that.
There is there's an Instagram feed of a woman who's an Irish woman who's going out. I think you turned me on to that.
I turn you on to that. Yeah, she finds antlers all the time and bits of them and bones and all the time.
The mega elk.
I'll have to find that out. I'll do a little aside onto whether I'm pretty sure humans would have existed along with the Megaloceros giant.
They
Irish
probably
elk.
Would have been easy prey with that 12-foot horn span antlers.
You never know. That could have also been a formidable weapon.
I was kind of right. The Irish elk, the Megaloceros, went extinct about 8,000 years ago, and the early inhabitants of Ireland arrived 9,000 years ago. So obviously they coexisted and probably helped their demise.
Always fun, Dave.
Yep.
Do it again, man. I guess the next one you're going to do, you're going to be roaming around.
Well, the next one, hopefully you'll be in Kansas and I'll be in Montana at the Museum of the Rockies. And we'll do
a recording there. Yep. And who knows, I might be able to pull one off here in Kansas where I'm currently,
that'd be fantastic.
Currently sitting.
And for the very first time, this isn't the first time, but I'm signing off from Ojai, California, where it's going to rain tonight. We've had so much rain this year. Yeah, our reservoir is up to almost 94%, and that's up from 30% during the height of the drought.
Wow.
Yeah, so they say we have 20 years of water now.
Wow. Well, I'm just whiplashing between landscapes because I go back to my home, my real home in Alaska, but this is where we're camping out in Kansas.
Kansas.
It reminds me where I'm at. But yeah, where they're actually suffering a drought. So, and that's been going on.
Oh, really?
Yeah, here in central, you know, Kansas, it's still a drought, technically.
It's funny because I always wonder about the listener. Here we do. We'll talk about certain events or times of year, and you could be listening to this in the winter when we're talking about a warm spring day. So sorry for that.
Well, you know, it's time traveling, man.
It's timeless.
Timeless.
It's a radio show.
Timeless, yeah. So anyway, signing off from Lindsborg, Kansas, where I need to go ponder that one even more. I'm going to go across the street to the old Stuka and have a pint and ponder that. So,
all right,
Sonny here. See you later, man.
See you later, Ray. Always a pleasure and an honor to a research author.
I'm a scientist. I'm really a scientist. All right. I'm an artist.
Bye.
Thanks for being a paleo nerd. Help us spread the word of science. Rate us on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can even email your questions and comments to nerds@paleonerds.com. Did you know each episode is paired with pictures and links? Check out paleonerds.com for photographic evidence that everyone here has been a paleo nerd for a long, long time.